This episode of DLC is brought to you by Alienware. So I've got a question for all the gamers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on Alienware's biggest gaming sale of the year? I mean, these are Black Friday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it during Black Friday. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories, like the Alienware 27 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance. So I'd visit Alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before their biggest sale of the year goes dark. Yeah, there it is! When that robot voice comes in, you know it is time to begin. And wherever you are, whenever you are, and however you happen to be listening, we're so glad you've chosen to tune in to DLC. Woo! Especially if you're one of our geeks and sneaks, using this podcast to power you through a workout or a run. Or hey, maybe you're basking in that late summer glow. Maybe you're strolling on a nice evening, cool summer night, watching the wind gently brush at the trees, a pet brushing against your ankles. Whatever the case, we're going to be in your ear holes for 90 plus minutes of gaming goodness, because DLC is your downloadable commentary for the week, delivered the way we love it to be. And that is completely free thanks to our patrons at patreon.com/DLCpod. Those folks bring the show to you. Their support, their generosity, their belief in what we're doing here. Boy, it matters. It means something. It means we get to keep making the show. And in exchange, they get some cool perks, including ad-free versions of the show, video versions of the show on demand. And you got your bonus content. Oh, so much of that glorious bonus content, spoiler chats. We've got the Wednesday paid DLC program with Lana Bashinsky joining us to talk about all the stuff that the patrons want to talk about, exclusive to patrons, plus a fine program we call Feeling This, where Alex Solman and Christian Spicer talk about the feelings behind video games. Season 3 in full swing. Get it while it's hot at patreon.com/DLCpod. But this show, the main show, DLC, that's the show all about games and their many forms. Games played on desktops, laptops, and consoles. Also games that involve dice, luck, and cardboard. I'm your host, Jeff Cannata, the spell with two N's and one T, and I am joined, as always, by my friend, slash co-host, slash nemesis, the guy who will not be seeking a second term on the show, Mr. Christian Spicer. Hello, Christian.
Can't seek a second term when you're still in your first. That's the beauty of having never missed a week, Jeff. We're still in our first
in
season.
In our first term. Yeah.
Our first season of DLC episode.
Season one, going strong at 558 episodes.
We're like a soap opera. We get our script right when we sit down. We just keep cranking out episodes.
I hide mine in the folds of the blankets. Just like all the soaps I used to do. Hey, we got an awesome show for you, ladies and gentlemen. We have some really interesting news to dig into, some fun games to talk about, and one of our favorite guests. You know that DLC always stands for your downloadable Kanata and your downloadable Christian, but I am excited because once again, DLC stands for designer and lead creator, because we have lead gameplay designer as well as the co-host of Feeling This, as you heard me say, Mr. Alex Solman is back with us. Hey, Alex, how are you?
Hello, fine gentlemen, fine friends. I am very excited to be back. Yes, very excited to be a part of the DLC family. Excited to be on the main show again. Appreciate you guys having me back on. Excited to talk about all things happening.
It is our pleasure.
Good friends.
Our pleasure. Tell me a little bit about season three of Feeling This. People have gotten the first few episodes,
yes.
But more to come. And I know you guys are looking at some really juicy, interesting feels. The feels. Tell us about
feels.
It.
Feels. Yes. The emotional feels, the mechanical feels. We're way organized this time, aren't we, Christian? We have a Google Doc. More organized, shall we say.
More organized, yeah. There
we go. Listen for the feels, stay for the Google Doc.
Yes, absolutely. That's what it's all about. No, I continue to really enjoy the discussions that we have. As a gameplay designer, right, I think we talked about this the very first time I was on the show. I'm obsessed with the game, the way games feel, like the mechanical way that they feel, the way that they make you feel. And I think having someone like Christian to discuss those ideas, those topics, those elements of games that, you know, feel good in a positive way, the way you guys always do in this podcast family, is great. And I think the thing I love about the show, I think, Christian, you coined this really well in one of the recent episodes, is we both come at it from a slightly different angle, and that creates, I think, really interesting conversation about these topics and how they make us feel and what's good about them, and sort of sometimes diving really deep into those mechanical elements that, you know, me as a gameplay designer have been lucky enough to, you know, to be immersed in for many years. And I really enjoy that combination of discussing the way they feel to each of us and what those elements are, and going back and forth on, you know, what elements stand out to us. So I think I continue to enjoy it. I love the time I get to spend with Christian, and just glad that people enjoy listening to it. It's very fun.
I believed you up until that last part. Enjoying the time with Christian.
But that's why I'm back on the main show, Jeff. So that I get to be with you too. See?
No, Christian, it's been awesome hearing you guys back at it again. I'm glad the show is still going strong. You're still finding new feels to feel. We're glad, especially, that we can offer it to our patrons. You can support the show literally at any level and get Feeling This as part of your feed. You get a special RSS feed for it. So you can support the show at any level at patreon.com/DLCpod. Christian, I know you're having a blast doing it too.
It's great. And this every season's a little different. The first two complete seasons are out already. We're three or four episodes into season three. And we, you know, we listen to audience feedback. We tweak the show a little bit based on what folks are digging, what they kind of want to see change. So this season has its own flavor to it. I think difficulty is what came out on Friday as of recording this. And it was a fascinating conversation, because I think when you think about the mechanics of difficulty or what makes something feel difficult, and trying to disassociate that from break controller difficult, you know, there's like things that are meant to be frustrating, things that are frustrating in spite of themselves. And so I think it was a really fun and interesting conversation. I think people are digging them too. So I'm glad people are listening. And I like pretending that I know what I'm talking about, Jeff, as you well know.
Oh, I know. Yes. We'll get a little more of that in the coming 90 minutes. Speaking of which, let's jump in and start the show the way we always do, with Story of the Week.
Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week. Story of the Week. It's the Story of the Week.
Story of the Week is the part of the show where we make our case for the most important stories that happened in the world of games this week. You can always submit stories for our consideration by sending us an email to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. You can also send comments, questions, anything you'd like us to know. Boy, we love hearing from you. dlcfeedback@gmail.com is the email address. But you can also reach out and talk to other like-minded folks, other members of the community, over on our Discord, which is 5x5DLC on Discord. Great people hanging out there. I urge you to take part, folks. But Alex, you are our guest, so you get first pick of stories. What would you consider to be your story of the week?
Ooh, yes, I do get first pick. I'm excited. I'm going to leave the two big stories for you guys to digest. Well, arguably the two big stories on our sheet. Anyway, I would love to talk about the Evo stuff. I thought there was some super cool stuff that came out of Evo, specifically as a big fan of this game, SVC Chaos coming out, getting tweaked, new training modes, new hidden arcade characters, like, I'm a big fan of SVC Chaos. I think it gets a little underrated, given that maybe, you know, it was a little late. It was, you know, an incredibly expensive Neo Geo cart at one point. So I kind of love that game's getting another lease of life and getting a comeback.
Yeah, we are in, by all accounts, what has to be described as a new golden age of fighting games.
Mm-hmm.
Not only are the games coming out at very high caliber, with frequency and you know, high quality, but this year's Evo is the biggest in the event's history.
Mm-hmm.
More than 10,000 unique competitors facing off. That's massive. Over you know, a variety of different fighting game titles, and some really interesting announcements, as Alex was indicating. We got this more multiverses action. Season 2 is going to have Samurai Jack in it, which, man, what a cool character. And Beetlejuice will be releasing a little bit later to coincide with the second Beetlejuice movie. We've got a variety of different fighting games announcing new characters, new seasons. But Alex, you were bringing up specifically this old Neo Geo game.
Yeah.
So tell me about why that's exciting to you. Is it, are you just sort of nostalgia? Were you a fan of the game in, you know, in the old days? Or what's your enthusiasm come from?
Yeah, mostly nostalgia. And I love the fact that, you know, some of the games that maybe don't get as much credit as maybe they did, as maybe they should have at the time, get to come back with this new lease of life, new netcode, new ways to sort of experience what was a really, you know, was an amazing experience, right? It was an amazing game that came out of time that, you know, maybe wasn't as, it wasn't destined to be as popular as it could be now. And getting it on Steam and getting it, you know, on modern consoles and allowing people to dig in what is, you know, for me at the time, was almost like the weirdest combination you could imagine, seeing SNK characters and Capcom characters kind of coming together into the same space. I was like, what is happening here? This is so weird. And I just think it was a really unique, had some unique mechanics in its fighting system. It's very strictly 1v1, not like any of some of the tag team stuff that they've done. And yeah, just that great mix of some great characters from great Capcom characters, you know, franchises like Street Fighter and Darkstalkers, which I loved, and then throwing into Metal Slug, and like there's so many good little characters and nods to those two illustrious companies. And I think it's on my mind because I do a video game history club at my local school, and we were just talking about I've done a week on SNK and I've done a week on Capcom, and it just reminded me that this thing existed, this smashing of these two great companies that have such an intertwined history.
Yeah,
I was like, oh, I forgot how much I love that game. I'm excited it's coming back.
I also had forgotten this thing existed at all. It's cool. And it was kind of shadow dropped onto Steam, mm-hmm. you know, with netcode and stuff, as you said. Very, very cool. Christian, we've sort of lived through this, the rise and fall of esports to a certain extent. Now, it's not gone completely, and I don't mean to write it off. I'm sure there's lots of people listening that still really enjoy some esports, but the fervor around esports has waned undeniably. But I think the one exception to that, possibly, is fighting games. And we're certainly seeing Evo going strong and thriving in 2024. What's your take on what happened this weekend?
Yeah, that's a great point, Jeff. I think what makes Evo so special is, and someone will probably, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. Pushback. I understand that there might be some pushback here. But Evo, in my opinion, is generally a grassroots thing. The fighting game community building up their own tournaments and leading into this culmination, this celebration, much like so much of this show is, of the fighting game community and the fighting game scene. And so, yes, Evo has big corporate sponsors and people that run this event, but it is also more than one game. It's not Smash. You know, it's a tournament where there's major Mortal Kombat tournaments and major Street Fighter tournaments and major Tekken tournaments. And so it is this culmination, again, to use the word, the celebration of the fighting game community that I think is really endearing and happy, you know, and a celebration. Whereas so many of the other esports, I think, were just one game. The league was run by the company that makes the game. The other game that was the original spinoff that this game is based on isn't allowed to be mentioned. You know, it's like this kind of this weird bubble that so many of them live in. And I think another thing that makes Evo so really special is that it is this in-person event. Yes, you can stream it online, and that's how I've been watching a lot of it and how most people do. But you get all of these incredible players, again, across all these different games in one place playing them. And because they are fighting games, I think it solves what's an easier version of understanding what's going on the screen. Jeff is playing as Chun-Li. Christian is playing as E-Honda. Jeff wins. You know, like you can see, except for when we actually did that at Button Mash.
That's not how I remember
There's
it,
video. the one time I won, we filmed it. I love it. I think that really helps with people understanding what's going on. And it's also fun to see people like play across different games, you know, dip their toe into Mortal Kombat, play some Street Fighter. So I think it just does so much right from a grassroots level all the way up.
No, you make great points. I certainly that latter point that you made, it was kind of what I would have just left it at, frankly. I think that is, from my mind, a very big part of the success of watching something like Evo, especially from home, or watching the matches, is just how fighting games translate to being very watchable, generally speaking. There's some intricacy that you will miss if you're just a casual fan, but you understand big character against another big character and they have life bars, and one lone life bar goes down, that's it. You know, you get it. That said, I really do. I think you're onto something though with the sort of contextual layer of Evo being not even really presented like a sport, but more like just a tournament of individuals. And I think there's something compelling about that in and of itself. Of you know, this there's a Fred Savage and the Wizard element to just something so watchable, and you can get behind these individual people, and you don't have to know the team dynamic. I think there's something to that. Alex, this definitely gets into feeling this territory of you know, is there something to the feel of fighting games that contributes to their success on this kind of spectator sport level?
That's a great question. I on a spectator sport level, I think a lot of the rules that make games feel good, right? Christian and I talk about this all the time, right? To me, games are interactive, right? And therefore, to be interactive, it's about call and response. When I ask the game to do something, it communicates back whether I've done it or not. And the better that it communicates that back and the outcome of that, usually the better the game feels. That's a gross generalization, but I think that's sort of, you can approximate that. And that feedback that you get in a fighting game, right, the hit pause, the impact flash, the health bar changing, a lot of the stuff we talked about in several episodes of Feeling This, I think is very easy to look at, right? It's very easy to follow. It's very watchable. And to your point, you know, the premise of the experience is very simple, right? It's 1v1, or maybe, you know, maybe a bit of team matchup, but, you know, it's two players fighting against each other. And I think the combination of the really watchable, great feedback, many of the rules that apply to a game like Street Fighter, we would dissect and use in games like God of War that I worked on, right? There were lots of rules that we pulled from in terms of hit frames and wind up poses, anticipations, wind downs, all the kind of rules that fighting games follow in, you know, great fighting games execute very well. Very similar rules if you're trying to create that kind of experience in any game. I would say that a lot of the feedback that you get from that experience translates well, whether, you know, has to translate to the person playing, but also translates really well to someone watching.
Yeah, great point. The other thing I think is a major contributing factor that may be easy to overlook, but I think plays no small role in its watchability, is that everything is there on the screen that you need. If I'm trying to watch Counter-Strike or Overwatch or something, and we're popping between the different views, like, what's happening over here on this side of the map? And oh, they've broken off. They're going around. They're trying to, you know, it's kind of just the geometry of the interactions themselves are hard to convey. The pure layout of where everyone is in relation to one another. You have none of those problems in a fighting game. It's all there on one static stage. And I think that that also helps. But the games, I also think the games have gotten real good. You know, the games have gotten real good, and it's fun to watch people at high skill levels have these very, you know, high skill ceiling game interactions. It's fun. We also got, I should not leave out, we also got a an announcement of a new King of Fighters. Mm-hmm. King of Fighters 15 is coming in December, SNK announced at Evo. Alex, are you excited about a new King of Fighters?
I'm actually more of a classic King of Fight KOF fan than a modern fan. I haven't really clicked with the modern ones, honestly. There's something about the 3D look that, to me, you know, KOF will always be a 2D, beautiful 2D fighter. Not that they're bad games; they're incredible games. I have a couple of friends that I used to work with that love those games and still play them. You know, still play all the new releases. So,
yeah, I think I got this wrong. I got new characters are coming. King of Fighters, yeah. 15 December. Sorry, just Vice and Mature are coming. Now the game has been out. That shows you how much I know about King of Fighters. The game has been out. Two new fighters are coming in December. So yeah, still cool. Still cool.
And I do think, to your point, Jeff, there is a lot of technical nuance to playing a fighting game, right? There's loads of layers of complexity that, much like, you know, an Overwatch or something like that, that nuance is really hard to grok unless you've played those games. And a lot of the announcers do a really, really good job of conveying it back. But you still get those moments. I happened to see a clip of... the Street Fighter 3, right? Street Fighter 3 Third Strike is still in Evo. That game has been around for ages. It's still played competitively. And many of you may remember the Daigo moment from years ago when he parried everything and came back. Somebody did that similarly, but with Hugo this year.
So cool.
And when they pulled it off, they won the tournament with it. I just went like running around the stage, like high-fiving everyone, because it was one of those moments. To your point, it's not just the game, it's the personality, is the moment that happens that people can, you know, get behind and get excited about, and Evo really centers it on that experience, which is so cool.
Toot my own horn a bit. I hosted a show for Hulu a few years ago called Defining Moments that was all about stuff like this, and I got to interview Daigo and talk about that exact moment, which if people aren't familiar with, there's a moment where very classic moment. I can't even remember what year it happened, but it was where Chun-Li's, you know, million leg kick, whatever it's called, that's, you know, attacks a bunch of times over and over. Daigo countered every single one of those, which had to be frame perfect in order for it to work. Mm-hmm. And it's an amazing thing. You can still find it online. It's really, truly thrilling to watch. And the crowd just goes bananas when he pulls it off. All right. Well, that's Evo 2024. So cool that it's thriving and people are jumping on board and there's more and more competitors. Really, really cool stuff to see. Christian Spicer, what is your story of the week?
Well, quickly, just a tag on Evo. We are recording just a few hours early on Sunday, so there still might be one more stealth drop. I don't think so. Everybody was hoping for a stealth release of the Marvel or the Capcom Fighting Collection MVC2. Instead, they stealth dropped Chaos, which I think is a pretty dang cool stealth drop. But in case you're listening and it's like, the most amazing thing happened, they talked about Evo for 12 minutes and didn't talk about that, because it happened right after we finished recording, as we do. Man, there are big, big stories. I'll take one of them, Jeff. I'll take one. I want to talk about this college football thing, but I won't. Maybe we will later. That stuff fascinates me. Maybe I'll save that for a Wednesday discussion, Jeff. It's not necessarily too timely per se, the idea of early access. I want to talk a little bit about the FTC and Game Pass and the continuing evolution story saga of the merger acquisition of Activision Blizzard with Microsoft, which I was not on last week's show, where you all talked about that, Jeff.
Specifically the changes to Game Pass, the increase in price and the changing of the tiers and adding a new tier. We talked about that last week. This is sort of a direct fallout, if you will excuse the
which is on Game reference. Pass.
Yeah. happy 16 Emmy nominations fallout. Anyway.
Yeah. Yes, yes, yes. And so this week, the FTC released a letter regarding its appeal about Game Pass not being great, or the merger not being great for consumers, and they used these new changes to Game Pass as evidence, as an example of why it wasn't a good thing and why they were trying to fight it and prevent it. And, which is rare to happen for our show, before recording, Microsoft replied and said,
"They just, no, the FTC just posted the GIF of the guy going, the meme. Remember how they promised us we wouldn't do this exact thing? This is the exact thing we said they were going to do. And then the government was like, they're not going to do that thing. See how they promised not to do the thing? And they're like, they did the thing.
Maybe we should follow up. Look at us.
The thing we said they were going to do, they did.
Look at us. Here we are. Who would have thought? You and me. We're here again. And it's about, and this is just going to be you and I having this conversation, Jeff. But it's about product degradation was the term. And Microsoft pushed back and said it's not. And they phrased,
they're like, you're degradating. You're a degradator. Nobody. This is whole thing. I know I'm infantile. Making it infantile, but I think it's hilarious. I think this entire exchange is hilarious.
Well, so I feel like I'm trying to parse my words, because while this isn't necessarily legal, it's not in court yet with this, but I do feel like this is the battle of proper nouns, right? Like it's very much, I'm getting lawyer flashbacks. And so Microsoft pushed back and said, this isn't it. By creating this new tier, we've actually created value, because before you used to have to get Xbox Live Gold or Core and Game Pass if you wanted to get catalog games and online capability. And now we've got that, and we don't mention that we cut the other thing that most people. And so I just find it fascinating. I know that lawyers looked at this change before putting it out, right? They were like, okay, with the mergers done, we're going to degrade, we're going to do product degradation to our services. How can we make it look like we don't? I'm fascinated by the timing. But what I think is most interesting to me, Jeff, is the FTC coming back. Because I think for me, this signals an FTC that is going to continue to fight large tech mergers, because there's no reason they had to say anything here, right? But they did. And I think they're trying to plant their flag and say, we are actually looking out for you, consumer. We're going to continue to. We thought this was bad then. Here's why. Look what happened. I think that's fascinating.
You say they didn't need to say anything, but I feel like they did need to say, they did need to respond, right? They need to, the FTC is like, this is why we're going to appeal. And they're like, appeal? Bad idea. No appeal. Don't do that. Don't do it.
Yes, but it doesn't need to be this court of public opinion issuing of statements, right? Yeah, like, yeah.
But I don't think this was the FTC's a statement. There's was a, they filed a letter with
a
the
letter
court.
In their appeal, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. I think both of these are, you know, basically talking to the public through the court. But we went through the roller coaster of this Activision Blizzard merger over many months, and it was very fun. Created a lot of content for this podcast. We appreciate that. And in the end, you know, the thing that we thought was going to happened from day one. The merger went through. And the billions got paid and the companies got bigger. And the entire time, the FTC, which I think to some people's mind, not everybody's, but to some people's mind was the villain in this situation, like trying to stop my Game Pass from getting that sweet, sweet Call of Duty. You know, they were basically saying, hey, when you get a monopoly, nothing can stop you from raising prices on the people. That's the whole point of monopolies. And why we want to stop them is because there's no competitive challenge. There's no fair market to keep prices down because nobody's competing for your dollars. Microsoft is like, that's ridiculous. As soon as we get Call of Duty, we are going to definitely raise prices, which we did. It was pretty sweet how we got Call of Duty and then we raised prices right away. Oh, yes. You kind of got to go, FTC's got a point. They got a point. And I find Microsoft's response to that pretty flimsy, personally. Just basically saying, FTC presents a misleading extra record account of the facts and is a continuation of the agency's attempt to reinvest its case reinvent its case on appeal. It's it says it doesn't talk about multiplayer functionality, which we added in. We added that in. And I like this one. It, quote, the service will offer more value through many new games available day and date, in particular Call of Duty, which has never before been available on a subscription day and date, which is exactly what they're like. FTC's like, you're saying what we said, which is as soon as you get Call of Duty, everything changes. So, man, I think this is going to be interesting to see if this appeal happens and if there is some. It's hard to undo, you know, something that has been done. So I suspect that won't happen.
That's where I feel like this is the FTC signaling forward challenges to trying to say, hey, we are not going to just roll
next
over.
Time. This,
yeah. Yes, we're going to continue to fight these things.
Yeah, possibly. But man, it's a wild thing to see the exact thing that Microsoft promised they wouldn't do. They're like, no, you said you wouldn't be able to get it on other systems. It's going to be on other systems. It's like, well, that's not all we said was going to happen.
And it's wild too, because part of me, I think the problem. So one thing that I wasn't on last week's show, and so I posted this in our Discord, but I'll mention now too. One thing I think is interesting about the changes to Game Pass is just what it says about the core Xbox player, the person who only owns an Xbox console. Their Game Pass experience has either gotten worse or twice as expensive.
Yeah.
Whereas the PC player is cheaper, as you mentioned, or you have the bundle.
But well, if you don't have cheaper, a PC, it's just it's $2 just, more. But yeah,
okay, yes, but it doesn't get rid of something.
Yes.
And I find that fascinating to the core player. But what I find otherwise interesting, and I'm really, again, legalese wording is always going to be annoying, but also it's like, yes, of course it's more expensive. And if you like the games, it still is a great value, right? It's like if Marvel Unlimited, which is a subscription service that gives you Marvel comics, I think it's like after 3 months after they come out in print, you get them. If they then came out and said, hey, we are going to start including DC Universe or whatever the DC subscription is, include it. We're going to get all the DC comics also.
Right.
And everyone would be like, well, it has to be more expensive. And they're like, yeah, we'll deal with that later. And then it comes out and it is more expensive, but it's still cheaper than having both of them. That's still a win for you, the consumer, if you want those other comics. So here, if these Activision games coming to the service is super valuable to you, this still seems like a great thing and a great value. If you have no interest in those games, this really sucks.
Well, I
and
feel
I
like
that's the problem with the sub. You either like the content and you think you're getting your money's worth, or you don't and you're not getting your money's worth.
I feel like you and I have switched positions on this somehow today, because I feel like I'm going to be the one that says the thing that you always say, which is, yeah, it's still a good value today. But I think the FTC's position is like, hey, if this is the only place you can get a Call of Duty, and Call of Duty is the thing, then what's to stop them from charging whatever they want for it? There's no market pressure to keep the price down. Now, I don't completely agree with that, because I don't completely agree that Call of Duty is the end all be all of video games, right?
I mean, it's way better than Battlefield, though. Who wants Battlefield?
But it's hard not to see the slope getting a little slippery, if you know what I mean. It's like, it's just brazen how fast it happened. You know, it's like, Your Honor, the idea of us raising prices is simply shocking that you would, because it's the first time we've even thought of this. You suggesting we raise how they would think, just because we bought for $70 billion these companies, we would raise prices. Cut to 2 months later, we're raising prices. It's like, it's pretty wild. But you're not wrong. It's still a great deal. I'm still paying it. I'm not canceling my subscription. It's still like an incredible deal. And I'll probably play a Call of Duty campaign for the first time in several years this year, because it's in my Game Pass.
I did turn off my auto renew.
Did you? I'm bumping down to the PC thing because I don't.
Yep. It became a Ubisoft for me, where like I will sub for a month when there's the games I want, like when Star Wars Outlaws comes out, and I'll gobble them all up. But I don't know if it's going to be it's expensive to keep all year and just not think about price point and combined with the the layoffs and stuff. It's hard, man. The gaming industry is hard, but on the other side of that, not even the same coin, but also. What big Sony games have come out this year? It's hard. It's a really frustrating couple of weeks, I feel like. And here we are in the dog days of summer. And it's frustrating, I think, is how I'll leave it, I guess.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got some more story of the week to get to. But let's take a quick break for a sponsor. We'll be right back right after this. This episode of DLC is brought to you by Green Chef. Green Chef, the number one meal kit for clean eating, delivering pre-portioned and prepped quality whole foods with limited processed ingredients. Green Chef sends organic, fresh produce, responsibly sourced proteins, and chef-designed recipes in every box for satisfying, nourishing, and convenient meals then make it easy to stick to a clean routine. Christian, I got to tell you, I think I mentioned this last time we talked about Green Chef. We have completely converted over to Green Chef. I love my meal kits, and I understand why Green Chef is the number one meal kit for clean eating, because the recipes are delicious. We're all over Green Chef at this point. I'm like, that's my only meal kit at this point.
I thought you were going to just say just because of the black bean and veggie burrito bowls. And I mean, that you could have just stopped after that. And I was like, yeah, you're right. you said all that other stuff. That's true, too. But that's all you needed to say.
That is an excellent menu. They have over 80 weekly menu items and market options, which satisfy every taste bud. Honestly, one of my favorite things to do is pick my meals week to week. And I love that Green Chef gives me a few extra days of wiggle room to pick my, usually these types of things you get 1 week. No, Green Chef lets you go all the way to the end of the week. I love it. I go Wednesday to Wednesday. They let me pick my meals up to Friday, which is super nice. You get variety and convenience. I'm eating stuff that I would never be able to cook on my own without this stuff. And with no waste, I get pre-portioned ingredients. I get exactly as much as I need. I don't have stuff going in the fridge that's just going to go bad. I'm going to be throwing into the garbage later. And Christian said, some of our favorite recipes, delicious stuff. It feels like I'm eating at a restaurant. Plus, you got clean meals that suit your lifestyle. You got Mediterranean, plant-based, gluten-free, protein-packed, keto, calorie smart, gut health. And they've got every box has foods you can feel good about. Whole fruits and vegetables, plus lean proteins and whole grain options. Check it out. Go to greenchef.com/DLC50 and use code DLC50 to get 50% off, plus 20% off your next 2 months. That's greenchef.com/DLC50. And that code is DLC50. Get you 50% off. Plus 20% off your next 2 months. Green Chef, the number one meal kit for eating well. All right, my story of the week. This is one. It's another one that Alex will have to sit out for. But because we don't want to put him in a conflicted position at all, just to be on a guest on our show. But I do want to talk about Bethesda's Union, which is going to happen. It sounds like. This week, Bethesda Game Studio workers announced that they have formed a union under the Communication Workers of America, the CWA. This is the first studio to fully do this since being acquired by Microsoft. And Microsoft has already acknowledged them as a union. They will have collective bargaining procedures in place for dealing with that union. So,
which is a great example of them doing what they said they would do pre-merger. Right. They said that we are not going to challenge these things, and they haven't still,
Yeah. Well, we'll see how this goes, right? We'll see how this goes. But we have talked at length over years on DLC about our stance with regard to unions. We are both, Christian and I, both very pro-union. I am a member of several unions, and I believe in collective bargaining as a tool for labor. And we have long called for and hoped for the video game industry moving in this direction, and this is a huge step. It's not the first step, but it is a huge step. Mm-hmm. And this is what 241 members of the studio, a large group of people that have all voted for this to happen. I think this is a positive step forward, and probably another domino that's going to continue to lead to more unionization inside the industry, which I think is good. I hasten to add, as somebody that has been in unions, is the child of people that were in unions, that lived in and around the union process my whole life.
You meant like a wedding, right? Like a child of a union, marital union.
That dissolved. They divorced, frankly.
That's collective bargaining did not
work out for me. Even though I paid my dues. I think there may be some misconception that the step of unionization will somehow prevent mass layoffs, as we've seen. It does not do that, right? It does not magically prevent more layoffs from happening. It gives employees some bargaining power and some repercussions when those things happen, and some tools to use to try to mitigate the circumstances with which they happen, and how to try to have a safety net in place for employees. So I don't want people to get ahead of their skis on this one and say, oh, well, this is the end of, giant layoffs. No, people still get laid off when they're in unions. They just have services. They have things that they are now empowered to be able to do and receive as a result. But Christian, I know you join me in celebrating this announcement.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be interesting going forward how these in-studio unions function versus the unions, one of the unions you and I are more familiar with, SAG-AFTRA, and that is across studios, right? When you are a SAG member, you are not a Paramount SAG member. It's all acting, and a lot of the stuff for a lot of unions that way, auto workers, sometimes it is just it's the plant, but any auto worker, any car manufacturer that goes in there, it's those auto workers. And so there's different types of unions, certainly, and there have been specific to company unions before as well. But I think for the first step for the video game industry to kind of figure this out, a Bethesda union, and let's say if there's a Sony Santa Monica union, hypothetically, like those would be different things under kind of the system that's emerging within the games space.
Well, they're aligned with the Communication Workers of America, the CWA. So it's a larger, just in the same way that when I was when I sold tickets in a box office, I was part of IATSE, which is right. A very large union that has a whole bunch of different types of laborers in it. I think in the same way, they are part of the Communication Workers of America, which gives them even, I think, more structure and more bargaining power.
Yeah, and certainly like that national leadership help, because organizing this stuff and knowing how to draft the type of communications you're going to need as you're talking to leadership and negotiating, but it doesn't necessarily connect you with other game developers that are also perhaps part of the same union, because this isn't a way where trade secrets, for example, are exchanged, right? That you don't have this gray area where everybody's getting together and across studios and perhaps negotiating, but it does feel like a very big step. And as our last story was kind of a hat on to Microsoft, this is a hats off for them being standing by their word and not fighting this stuff. And Activision was fighting this stuff tooth and nail prior to the merger. And this seems great.
Yes. Yes. But also, we haven't seen any negotiation actually happen yet.
Yes, so that's true.
When that happens, we'll see how entrenched Microsoft wants to be as far as you know, and we'll find out what the studio workers want to fight for. Like, we don't even really know what their demands will be, right? When a contract is formed. And I think all of that stuff we will cover as it moves forward here on the show, because I'm fascinated by it. And I can't wait to see what things will be in place in a Bethesda Studios union.
Demand one, we all get power armor for real. Demand yeah. two, see
fix
demand
our pit
one.
Boys.
Yeah, fix our pit. demand three.
Sorry, go Christian.
I was going to say, we want to know what happened in Vault 4. That's all. Just a dumb joke.
Yeah, we all want to go to the Emmys. I'll say, right, this is purely me speaking as Alex Solomon, not related to anywhere where I would do, you know, where I work. I'm fascinated by this. Like, I think you had a guest on the show a while ago who was also English and had a very complex relationship with unions. Mm. So I consider myself very union curious, right? I feel like there's seen a lot of bad things happen with unions, and then I hear you guys talk a lot of good things about unions, and other friends talk a lot of good things about unions. So I think, to your point, it feels like both of these stories are really indicative of this industry changing quite dramatically, maturing in, you know, different ways, and leading to quite complex results, right? The first story leads to really complex legal stuff. This yeah. one, as you said, leads to really interesting, complex relationships between studios within, publisher arms, broader than that across, you know, bigger divisions. So this is super fascinating to me. I'm really curious to see where it takes us. I think I've basically grown up making video games, right? And I've been in the companies where you work, you're clearly being taken advantage of, you're laid off in very dirty ways. I do think the industry's matured a lot since then, even though even with all the current stories of layoffs, which are horrible and hard to hear, I do think a lot of us are older now, the industry's matured a lot. And so a lot of us kind of self-regulate some of the harder crunch times in some disciplines, not all disciplines. So I think where unions fit within the various disciplines within video games, I think is also interesting. You know, seeing localization and QA testers kind of union, and yeah. now seeing designers and engineers union, that's really interesting. So I'm kind of stoked to see where this goes.
Great point. Yeah, I agree. And like you said, it is, I think, a sign of where the industry is as a whole. And mm-hmm. I think it's a good sign in a sort of abstract sense. It's like, yeah, we are in this place where this is necessary to think about, if not even act on. And now seeing people act on it is also, I think, inspiring.
And if people are wondering why we usually have a different guest on this show every week, it's because we hire someone, exploit them for their labor.
That's right.
And then fire them dirty right after the show.
That's true.
Hopefully there's no DLC guest union, because Alex, spoiler, you're out of here after this show, buddy.
I know this video straight for 19 hours. Please let me go.
Oh, this is a crunch week. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. We will let you go. Just
are you
going to
serve me pizza?
You
are you going to serve me pizza to make me feel better about myself?
Yeah. If the pizza doesn't come, just wait longer.
But keep working while you wait.
But keep absolutely. Working. Don't stop. But also, yeah.
All right. Well, some interesting times for sure. Interesting times in the video game industries, and we'll keep our finger on the pulse as best we can here at DLC. But we have games that we need to talk about, so let's do it and jump in to our playlist.
Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us. Ooh, what you playing this week? Tell us on the playlist.
Christian mentioned it earlier. It is a kind of the dog days of summer. We always used to have the big lull during the summer period where there wouldn't be huge releases. That has sort of stopped happening, where stuff comes out all the time. But a little bit of a lull right now, and I'm curious.
Unless
Alex
you're
Solomon,
playing EA college football, and that's what.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
It's definitely not a lull right now.
Yeah. That's right. All the big sports, you know, Madden's about to come out, and NBA, and you know, all the big sports games are happenings. But I'm curious, Alex Solomon, what has been on your playlist of late?
Ooh, a couple of things. I'm very excited to hear about Kunitsugami, Christian, when it comes down to your turn. I haven't had a chance to play that yet, speaking of Capcom. But on my list, let's start with Assassin's Creed Mirage. I got that for Father's Day. I was really excited to play it. I'm an old school AC fan. I'm not as much of a modern AC fan. I found that Odyssey and Valhalla kind of, it sounds really weird, kind of deviated from the mechanical template that the old AC had, right, in their traversal and their parkour. Like, it was still there, but it was kind of much more about the RPG and the open world than it was about those AC mechanics. And I respect those games. You know, I've played them and I enjoyed them. But Assassin's Creed Syndicate was kind of what I considered the last pure Assassin's Creed, right, in the old style. And so seeing Mirage come out and kind of be very much a throwback to like almost the original Assassin's Creed, but pulling in some of those more modern trappings and styles, and it being an opportunity for a previous support studio to break out and make their own game, of which, you know, I've been in similar studios trying to do the same thing. Love seeing that this has, you know, come to fruition. I think a lot of people maybe discounted it because it was cross-gen and it was also cheap, right? It was cheaper than your normal release. It's big, right? Is it Valhalla and Odyssey big? No. But it's, you know, it's a decent chunk of game. It's very complex. It's well executed. It's high quality. I guess it's their Anvil engine, which, you know, seems to advance quite a bit. Again, it feels like they're sort of pushing that technology forward by making another game within a familiar template. And it feels like this really warm, deserty blanket that I put on that like reminds me of why I love Assassin's Creed. And I think it really tries hard to dive deep into the lore, not the future world lore, interestingly, very much just the old school lore, you know, the Hidden Ones lore, if you like, and like really celebrates that. And I feel like that has very much kind of drifted away in modern Assassin's Creeds. It's sort of nice to come back to a game that's like really trying to remind you of how cool the lore that they built for Assassin's Creed was right from the very first game. And there's some mechanics, some cutscenes and some, you know, some montages that really lean into that that I've really enjoyed. I've only played it for 5 or 6 hours, so I'm still fairly early, but really enjoying it.
That's great. I'm curious what you think of Shadows, because it seems to me that in the messaging around the debut of Shadows, and this may be temporary, but it certainly seems to me to be a trend that Ubisoft seems to be kind of indicating that Mirage was a failed experiment. You know, maybe I'm reading into it too much, but it seems like as a company, they're saying, no, we're going back this direction now, these huge, massive, you know, more RPG versions. What's your feeling?
It's difficult to say. I feel like AC Mirage was more about who made it than it was necessarily about the end products, right? Ubisoft has so many studios, many studios that have never really had a chance to make their own thing. I think this was Bordeaux, is that right? Ubisoft Bordeaux, yeah. Got to kind of own it and drive it, right? And when I was at DICE LA, sort of working as a satellite studio for the big, you know, the big mother brain in Stockholm, DICE, we had a similar thing, right? We were forever the support studio, got to play in someone else's, you know, playground and make our own stuff, but it was still sort of contained within a universe that we had to respect. And even though this is obviously still within the AC franchise, it's not like they've made a brand new game. Right. I feel like what they were trying to do was push their engine, push their team, grow their team knowledge, and create a really slick, advanced, you know, accomplished homage for those that wanted it. I think the fact that Jade is clearly going back to the Odyssey origins, Valhalla, which have been so successful, to me is proof that that's, you know, where AC is now. Mm. And I guess they're also, aren't they building some big hub-like experience as well?
That was what we got. We got the indication that when they had that big Assassin's Creed-centric direct where they're like, we're announcing 4 games and one of them is a hub world. But we haven't really heard anything since then about that.
No.
So who knows? But there's the vampire one that's coming.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember what the third one was that they talked about.
I can't either. But I feel like they're sort of trying to hedge their bets a little bit.
Yeah.
And I will say that when AC Mirage starts, it has a little bit that celebrates 15 years of Assassin's Creed, and they have these gold silhouettes of various different assassins from the various games sort of stand up with the rising Assassin's Creed music. And like, it gave me shivers, man. Like, I love that franchise. I'd forgot how much I love that franchise because I've kind of stepped away from it a little bit. So for me, as a fan, I think Mirage lands it spot on. Is it going to blow your socks off as revolutionary? No. Is it going to make you feel very comfortable? Yes. And it continues to do the thing that I respect Ubisoft for so much, which is it leans into a culture that me as a white English guy doesn't really know that much about.
Yeah.
And it leans into that culture this is a weird analogy, but in the same way as Moana did, right? When I watched Moana, I felt like, oh, I'm getting an insight into a culture by the people that love it.
Right.
And I feel like Mirage is doing that as well. Like they have this lovely little, and they've done it in the other ACs, but you have to go up to these actual story nodes and they will unlock the history of Baghdad.
Right.
And you go to the physical places, which have been modeled, you know, beautifully. And then you get to read history about them. And like, those are super compelling to me. And I know AC's done that in several. I've taken my kids on the history tour of Greece, right? Those things, yeah, they've done it before, and they do it so well. And I think it gives me this insight that, like, I respect and I really enjoy that they put that effort in and they commit to it.
So cool. Yeah. And I guess if we're looking for classic Assassin's Creed flavor going forward, it's going to be in those remakes that they've indicated are mm-hmm. coming.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll get more of that in that way at the very least. Yeah.
That's a good point.
What else is on your playlist, Alex?
So I also got Flintlock. That came out this week. Third-person action melee game right up my street, right up my jam. I haven't played a huge amount of it. It's a Souls Light, they call it. It's quite, you know, contained in scope. I think it's only like 20 or so hours or so, allegedly. It's a third-person action adventure, melee and ranged combination. You have this crazy little some of the names I haven't quite got down yet. But you have this little god called Enki, who's by your side, that kind of this pet that kind of runs around that can do godlike things, that they blend into the combat. It's very, from reading the developers, it's very much kind of an homage to God of War, you know, Kratos and Atreus. And it has a similar flavor. It's perhaps not quite as polished as I was hoping to be. I'm very picky, you know, given my job, right? I'm very picky on animations and motion. I feel like some of their locomotion is perhaps a little light and doesn't feel quite grounded enough. Very responsive, but doesn't immerse me in the world in the way that I like to. And some of the reads on some of the melee attacks can be a little tricky to, like, it's in a game that's often about counters, and especially playing it on hard, you know, taking those hits really hurts. You kind of want all that to be, you know, really perfect, frame perfect. I have a very high bar for that, so I'm overly picky. I've been a little frustrated with it overall, but their combo mechanic with using Enki to kind of stun enemies and build up this armor, this stun bar that then you can go in and break armor with, timing your flintlock shots when enemies are using unblockables. And they have a really cool XP system where you get XP bonuses for mixing and matching your combos, and you can bank it at any time. But the longer you wait to bank it and the longer you go without getting hit, the higher the multiplier goes. So you've kind of always got this interesting, like, trying not to get hit, which in a Souls-like is real hard when you're first digging into it. But it sort of creates this interesting push-pull mechanic that you can lean into. Obviously, you know, you can lean into it if you want, and it's a nice little compelling reason to master the mechanics. But overall, yeah, it's an interesting game. It's got a nice style to it, and yeah, I've been having fun with it.
So that's Flintlock on Alex's playlist. What else you got?
Just other couple of little ones. I have uninstalled and reinstalled Marvel Snap 4 times now. I'm on my fourth go around. I keep telling myself I've got to stop playing it. It's taking up too much of my life. I uninstalled it. I reinstalled it. I recently took a trip to Maryland for my job and reinstalled it, playing it again. but very much
blame Maryland. Why don't you?
No, not Maryland's fault. It's the flight's fault. It's sitting in the airport's fault. The hotel's fault. I was like, I don't care about mastering. I don't care about getting to infinite. I just want to have a fun deck and have a laugh. And I've got a fun little destroy deck that I really enjoy. It's probably not going to win, you know, get me very high, but it, overall it's a fun thing to play. So I've kind of gone back into it just with that mindset. And then shout out to my eldest son, Jake, who I've infected with the Marvel Snap virus. Because he was like, oh, should I play it? I was like, I don't know. And he was like, I'm going to try it. And then we just sat at the dinner table for like an hour and a half with him going through the tutorial and me going, oh, he was like, what should I do? I was like, oh, try this. Oh, wait till he gets card. I don't have that card yet. Oh, I can't wait to get that card. What's a discard deck? Oh, you've got so much to learn. Really had fun just kind of getting back into that. Just the intricacies of the strategy of that game are just, you know, and the execution of it. I mean, talk about feel. We should do an episode on, just a whole episode on the feel of Marvel Snap. Because most of our feeling in this episode, as we've talked about, Christian, tend to be about third-person action games, right? But the feel of Snap is, mwah, like, across the board.
So true. So yeah. Even hearing you talk about it, I'm like, maybe I should reinstall it.
Yes. Imagine how many games you could have gotten in if you just kept it installed during that reinstalling it time. You know, that's like 3-4 games right there.
Something's wrong with that, Christian. I went on installing again. It's definitely back on my rotation.
Man, I feel like it's good that I took it off, but if I put it back on, I'd be like, man, I'm overwhelmed by how much new there is in there since I've played it, but.
Yeah, I've sort of divorced myself from all of that. I feel like I'm very unlikely. There was a card I saw yesterday that completely broke one of my strategies. And I was like, oh, I didn't even know that card existed. That card is super powerful. I'll probably never get that. And that's okay. I'm literally just there for the fun of, you know, I don't really care whether I win or lose. It's just that combination deck that I have is just so fun to play that's kind of enough. I think that's hopefully that will help me regulate the addiction. But right.
Well, good luck with that.
Thank you.
And you have one last thing on your playlist, right?
One very last quick thing. Yeah, I mentioned I've been doing a video game history club at my kids' school.
Awesome.
And it's been so much fun. Like, I feel like kids learn a lot about the history they should learn about, but there's so much history in video games that just flies under the radar that there's fascinating stories in the way the things we all play and love now came to exist and came to be and died. You know, so many of them, you know, so many kids especially just don't even know existed. And I had an experience with that about 4 or 5 weeks ago. I did an episode on the Neo Geo and I had my Neo Geo playable. And so I do a little presentation, right? Talk about the history of the Neo Geo and SNK and how it came to be. And then I just let the kids go play games. And we had one version running and another version running. And I turned over and turned and looked at the original Neo Geo that was playing. And there were two of the kids in the class were just like at it playing Windjammers, which is an old Neo Geo game, basically a disc throwing game, two players just fighting top down in an arena. It's basically just a couple of buttons and a stick, and that's all it is. And they were like intensely competitive. And one of the kids, when the other kid sort of gave up, was like, "How do I play this more? How do I play this? This is amazing. What is this game? I've never heard of it before." Kid, it was made way before you were even a glint in your parent's eye. But the reasons why it are good are still good today, and you can actually pick up there's an emulated version of it by .mu. I know it's on PlayStation. I think it's on Xbox. There's actually a sequel that's been done, Windjammers 2, which is also amazing. But there's something about the original version that I just really, really love. And it's actually gone back into my rotation. I had my Neo Geo out the other day. My youngest kid wanted to play it, and we were just sitting there playing it. And then we played the modern version on the PlayStation again. I highly recommend, if you like twitchy arcade games, there's something about the simplicity, but it does one of the things that we talk about in feeling this, Christian, is it does a lot of interesting mastery with one button, right? Timing, context, stick deflection, right? You can get a lot of depth out of what appears to be a very simple control scheme. And those lessons for me are like gold, because those rules still apply today, right? There's no reason why those rules can't apply to a modern game that you're making. So sometimes diving into one of these old games and like really extracting why it's so interesting and so good is beneficial to me and also fun. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and also, you know, I think that kids are exposed to sort of that simplicity in mobile games mm-hmm. now, you know, yeah. where by necessity they're sort of having to be stripped away. The control complexity has to be stripped away because you basically only have tap and, you know, swipe as your inputs for many of these games.
Yes, but I would say actually, oh man, I would love to dive into this I would love to hear your opinion on that, your guys' opinion on this on a longer episode, but I think modern kids, or kids today grow up with a gameplay complexity and a mechanical complexity level that we were nowhere near. And only us that were like really into games when we were young yeah. would have, because when you look at the complexity of, you know, many modern games like Minecraft, like Fortnite, right? They are so complex.
Oh.
So complex.
100%. I mean, Minecraft alone
yes.
is so far beyond literally anything that was available yes. when I was 8. Are mm-hmm. you kidding me? Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I think that baseline understanding, like when we would make a God of War game, we would often talk about, like, we would tune it so that you could basically beat the game with square, square, triangle. And the
I feel seen finally. Thank you for that.
yeah, specifically for Christian, because all of the rest of us played it on hard because we uh-huh. knew what we were doing. No, we would tune it like the real experience was on hard. I don't think yeah. that's true anymore. I think if you look at, I think that's the reason why a lot of the Souls games are popular now, because they're obtuse and they're complex, and people feel the accomplishment of beating them. So I think that floor has risen so high now. And I look at my kids, the games they play, and some of these old games I put in front of them, and they're like, what do? I'm like, you just have fun. You just play it and win. And they're like, why? I was like, because it's fun. They're like, but, they don't yeah. have the depth that they're looking for. But then when you find one of these old arcade games that is just twitch and pure fun, and they're like, oh my God, this is amazing. What is this thing? It's really very satisfying.
That's cool. Well, Wind Jammers is the example, so check it out. Before we get to Christian Spicer's playlist, we're going to take another break for a quick sponsor. We'll be right back right after this. This episode of DLC is brought to you by Alienware. So I've got a question for all the gamers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on Alienware's biggest gaming sale of the year? I mean, these are Black Friday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it during Black Friday. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories, like the Alienware 27 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance. So I'd visit Alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before their biggest sale of the year goes dark. All right, Christian Spicer, what's on your playlist this week?
These are going to be play tastes, I would call. I have been out of the country for a while, and I got my toe in some games. I had my Steam Deck with me, but not tons and tons of time. So I don't want anyone to think I've beaten these games or run these to credits. Hour, maybe 3, maybe 4 hours at most with some of these games I'm going to talk about. First one I want to talk about is Evil v. Evil, which I think we talked about on the Summer Game Fest episode or wherever it was shown. I love that name. It's awesome. Just it's so evocative, right? It doesn't matter what the game is. It sounds awesome. Like, this is a game I would have bought as a kid when I saw the box art. It's like Evil versus Evil, and there's like a vampire with a gun on the cover. Yeah, I'm buying all of that merchandise too, right? I want the comic book. I want the hoodie. I want the video game. Love it. It is a first-person shooter meant to be played co-op, but you don't have to. PvE essentially game, but with a campaign, different from Helldivers 2, which yes, there's narrative in Helldivers 2, but not really a you beat this level then move on to this next level. In Evil v Evil, there are levels or missions that you are going through. Again, they say it is best played in co-op. I only played a tiny bit in co-op. Most of my playtime was solo play. And the premise is really neat. You are an awoken, you know, vampire who is a mercenary, a mercenary vampire. And you have guns because you're going out and killing these other occult and people that are trying to do evil things. And the kind of push-pull mechanic of the Doom 2016 style first-person shooter now is that you regen your health by sucking people's blood, which is perfect for what a vampire would do. And so it's kind of I think you actually have an independent melee, but it's kind of like that pulls you in close attack. The camera actually switches to third person and you bite their neck and, you know, revive your health that way. And it's a really cool, like it was in Doom, those new Doom games, mechanic for pulling you into combat. I think for so long as gamers, we were taught, you know, the Gears of War, Uncharted 1 era of games is that you shoot and then to heal, you hide behind a rock. You know, like that's how you rest. I think, Jeff, we did a sketch for that for Double Jump once where it's like, I'm beat up. What do I do? Hide for now. I feel, you know, reinvigorated. Yeah. Punch me in the face. Let me sit behind a rock for a minute. In Evil v Evil, I like that approach of keeping you in the fight, keeping things frenetic. Really fun. It feels like a lost PS2, early PS3 game. And I mean that in terms of visuals, which are not cutting edge by any stretch of the imagination, but also what I saw of it, the kind of progression upgrade path where, and I don't think this is a bad thing, but I think it's something to be aware of. It feels dated in that way in terms of how it's progressing the story, how it's wanting you to engage with the content that it's offering. And also it feels like that to me in the sense that I played on PC, but with a controller, but it feels like that era first person shooter where I attribute it kind of to Unreal-esque feeling where it feels like you're a cursor in the arena versus a character in the arena. I got the feeling that when I was in first person, I was just this dot floating around. My movement speed that you mentioned, Alex, for Flintlock, kind of the animation or weight in the world feels a little off. That's how I felt in Evil v Evil. I didn't quite feel connected to the world. But if you're okay with that, calling it jank isn't quite right, but that kind of jank or old school charm perhaps is a better way to put it. I think there's something super compelling with it, especially if you and your friends want to run through a bunch of games and just have dumb fun, which I think maybe sounds dismissive, but kind of like what you said, Alex, to your kids, like, why am I playing this? Because it's fun, you know? And if you're able to have that mindset, I think there's something really cool there. Just don't expect it to be, you know, the most polished cutting edge game that you've ever played. Evil v. I got a code, I should say, as well.
Evil v. That is Evil v. Evil. And what were you playing on PC? What were you playing on?
I was playing on PC. Yeah, it ran great. I had no problems, no issues, probably because it wasn't, you know, pushing things super hard. The other game, again, it's so funny. We talked about it's, I don't know how you say the first part, Kenitsu Gami, Path of the Goddess.
You nailed it. Capcom.
Yes, Evil v. Evil. Me pronouncing words. the new Capcom game. And when we talked about it as a story of the week announcement a few weeks back, I think, Jeff, there was a demo out that I hadn't played yet. And now that I've played the full game and what I read what the demo is, I think I've just played the demo. Like, that's how far I am. I think the demo was like three tutorial levels and then like the first two levels. And I haven't finished the second quote level yet. It's really interesting. I had no clue from what was shown from this game for Summer Game Fest. Maybe I just wasn't paying attention that it is a tower defense game. It is not a third person combat action game, Alex, as you know, I am prone to love.
Well, it's both, right? You're still doing action combat, aren't you?
Yes. You have direct control of your character during the combat time, but it is not, it is a square, square, triangle. it is not tuned, at least again, early in the game, for complex action and you kind of juggling a crowd, even DMC style or Bayonetta, you know, doing a bunch of intricate, easy combos perhaps, but intricate on-screen animations to keep an air juggle going. It is a day-night cycle where you are trying to get to purge or cleanse these worlds from some evil with terms I won't get right. And as you go into them, you have this goddess character who is following you on a path. And during the day, you are kind of doing your setup. You can cleanse civilians that are in the area, other structures that give you the gems or the currency you need to unlock those characters, those NPCs that you've cleansed, to work for you and kind of designate what they're going to be, what type of tower, quote unquote, for lack of a better term, that they're going to be. And then you can position them, and you can also stop the character that you're protecting along the path. So you don't have to have her go all the way up right to the gate, right where the enemies are going to be. You can say, oh, this is my defensible point. This is 300. You know, this is where Sparta is going to lay down the law. I'm going to put my forces here. And then you can speed the time cycle from day to night to kind of advance it if you think you're ready, or during the day if you have enough stuff to move her forward to clear the gate to get on to the next area to progress the game and the story. And I found it really interesting in terms of how it presents the world visually. I love the visual storytelling the game is doing, even just in the small moments. The way your sword has these tassels on it and what you use to purify, and kind of the narrative you're getting about the world by being in it, I thought was fascinating and beautiful. I don't tend to love tower defense games, and I found the things that rub me kind of the wrong way with those games in general still made me uncomfortable in this game, which is a me thing, and it's my anxiety. I never quite know if I have things set up right. I hyper-analyze what type of character I want to be or what type of tower I want it to be, and then when that person gets defeated or there's kind of a problem with my defenses that where the enemies are rushing in, I get frustrated and I wish that I could save scum my way through success. That is a me as a person type flaw. But the game is super interesting, and I think it's totally worth checking out. I think it might kind of fall by the wayside as a, quote, cheaper game. The way Alex mentioned Assassin's Creed Mirage, it is, I think, $40. But visually stunning, and I love that Capcom has taken a swing at this genre that is largely forgotten. And I do like the way you keep direct player control of your character, and you can move your, again, air quote, towers mid combat, where a lot of tower defense games, you kind of are locked into what you're going to be doing. And Path of the Goddess allows for that flexibility in terms of changing their positions. You also kind of going in and taking, you know, you can funnel them toward you as the player character, which I think is interesting. So I think there's cool stuff here. But know that it's a tower defense game. That I did not know that.
I was watching some footage of it because I haven't had a chance to play it yet. The camera is really interesting. It's much more kind of pulled out than I expected. And it looks like you've got, you know, kind of independent camera rotation, but then it's kind of an isometric viewpoint. How does that make the combat feel? Because it feels like intricate combat, but from a slightly distant viewpoint.
Yeah, it is kind of, it's not quite isometric in terms of overheadedness, mm-hmm, per se, right. But it is zoomed out and it kind of shifts around. Sometimes it's a little more on a 2D plane than other times. And I think the answer is the direct player controlled combat, again, I'm very early in the game, isn't that intricate. It's okay. Not as if I'm trying to do God of War style combos or even DMC style air juggles. I think you are just kind of managing the flow or being the tank if your towers aren't set up to your liking, or you want to funnel them a certain way, you can kind of go in and flag the ads and pull people a certain way. And so I think it works in that regard, because you want to see the broader playscape for a tower defense game than have the narrower, closer field of view for an action third a third person action combat game.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes sense. Yeah, it looks like you've got like a separate command bar as well that I guess you use to drive your people around. And really,
and you have to unlock your currency to unlock the type of thing you want them to be and upgrade them, and then move your the character you're protecting forward. So there's a lot of push-pull in it that I think folks who like tower defense games will really like. And I think it does some interesting stuff within that genre. It's just never been my favorite genre because of my anxiety. But Jeff, I think you should spend some time with it. I think this might really click for you.
Really? Oh, interesting. It reminds me, and maybe you'll disagree, but it's funny that we were talking about older Assassin's Creed games because it reminds me of a mode that was in an Assassin's Creed game.
That's what it was.
There was and I can't remember which Assassin's Creed game, but there was a mode where you had like the different syndicates and you were basically doing stuff like this, like placing people pre-match. It was a multiplayer mode, but I think you could play it PvE too, where you put like archers on the top of the roofs. And so it was kind of doing this tower defense-y stuff. Alex, it sounds like you're
I was trying to think. Yeah, you've triggered a memory, Chris, Jeff. I was trying to remember what third-person game I played that had it, because I feel like it wasn't Brotherhood. It was there was the third spin-off, wasn't there, of AC2. And I think that might have, because AC2 and, you know, had the sending people around resource managing thing, didn't it? Revolution. Yeah, I think it might have been Revolution that had it.
Yeah, I can't remember specifically which, but I remember playing it and it was like that, where it's like you're still in direct control of your character, but you're also placing allies around in a tower defensive way. And then they would get into trouble and you'd sort of have a lot of that same kind of tower defense-y, you know, whack-a-mole, where you're, you know, trying to put out fires in different areas of the map.
Yeah, it was called Den Defense. That's right. And it was in Revelations. Yeah, and it was, you're right. It was like that. You would start on the roof, you'd send people around, and then, you know, enemies would come attack you. Yeah, you're right. Oh, yeah, I forgot about that, man. Great memory. Wow, I completely.
As soon as I saw that game had that playstyle to it, because I agree with you, Christian, as when they first announced Kunitsugami Path of the Goddess, I was like, oh, this is like a Souls like you know, direct kind of third person action game. And then they slowly revealed that it was not that, and that was the first thing that occurred to me. I was like, oh yeah, I remember playing something similar to that in an Assassin's Creed. But anyway, looks really cool. What else is on your playlist?
The doors are hands. Again, the style of the game is, I think, unmatched.
Doors are hands. Really. Christian loves it. He's a classic doors as hands guy.
I've called my guy. We're renovating our house. I want these doors must be hands.
He's like, I only got her feet, but I'm sorry. Fresh out of hands.
The last thing I want to mention, again, I was traveling a lot, and this came out while I was traveling, which was fun to try to find enough internet that let it work for me to update the app. But I talked about Delta on iOS before. It is an emulator. It runs pretty much Game Boy through DS, I guess, is probably the most powerful system that it runs well. Super NES, GBA, all that stuff really, really well on iOS. And before, it used to just do the iOS version on iPad, which was fine. It was great. Jeff, I've texted you some pictures of my kids playing it on their iPad, where you could play it small or blown up. Now, there is a dedicated iPad version of Delta, and it is fantastic. Again, free app, no spyware crap in it, no advanced tracking garbage or anything like that. This is, it feels like just a passion project. It really does feel like a lost cause lost opportunity for Nintendo to do something official. It is so good and so polished, and the new iPad app allows for full screen on an iPad. So if you're playing a DS game, I think it works really well to have the iPad in portrait mode, so you can have the two big screens on top of each other. Of course, the iPad still has the touch, and that's how the DS was positioned as well, kind of a vertical stack. It looks incredible. It runs well. And I am just shocked at how, again, polished this app is, iteration after iteration, and now having it on an iPad, where now even with, I think it's Stage Manager is what the iPad, quote, desktop mode is, you can have multiple instances of emulated games running. I don't know who that's for, but these new iPads are so powerful. You can be like, oh, this is my Donkey Kong Country over here. Over here is my Pokemon Sapphire or whatever, like all running independently. But if you haven't downloaded Delta yet and you're curious about emulation on iOS, now is the perfect time to give it a whirl on iPad OS. It's fantastic.
That's Delta, the emulator. All right. I wanted to bring up something on my playlist. I've mentioned it in passing over a few weeks. I've been playing it a lot. But I wanted to bring it up this week specifically because it feels to me like the perfect thing to talk about with the two of you who are doing feeling this and talking about the feelings behind video games. Because my son and I have embarked on a prolonged campaign of Minecraft dungeons. My son, like every 8-year-old, loves Minecraft, but he was playing. The way this started actually is very funny. We went to a pizza joint that had a big stand-up arcade game of Minecraft dungeons. And there's a whole trend of stand-up arcade games that like spit out cards now. Have you guys seen this? Mm-hmm. Where you get to, hey, you put in your quarters, you get to play for a short time, but you got a card forever, you know, so you really got something.
To your parents' delight.
Yes. All around the house, in the couch cushions, cards. Anyway, he thought it was incredible. He's like, oh, Minecraft video game, want to play this? And it's basically Minecraft Dungeons. And I'm standing there as he's like, Daddy, please, more quarters so I can play. And I'm like, I think this is on Game Pass. We can play this at home. Like, I'm not going to give you another $3 of quarters to just have, you know, 14 minutes of game time, if that, you know? So he took me up on that challenge and he was like, okay, Dad, you said we could play this at home. Let's do it. And it has turned into truly one of the coolest bonding things that I've done with him together because we save it. We only play together. Actually, I realized that the chair is still set up where he sits next to me right here in my office. We do it on my PC, sitting side by side. So it's not in the living room. It's not on a TV. We don't play on the Xbox.
Play at home in super ultra wide, son. I will not stand here at this arcade.
Sadly, it doesn't support
16:9.
It does not support 32:9, Christian. Much to my chagrin. That's one of my biggest gripes. We made it into this very purposeful kind of father-son bonding time where he's like in my office playing next to me. And it has been a blast. And I came away being really impressed with how the team made this game and all of the wonderful design decisions that went into Minecraft Dungeons because it is – Diablo. I'm a huge Diablo franchise fan for decades and have put countless hours into Diablo. I love, action RPG looter games. I love the Diablo template. And I assumed that Minecraft Dungeons would sort of just be my first Diablo, you know?
Kidablo.
Which it what's that?
Kidablo.
Kidablo. Even better. See, that's why he's here. That's why he's the designer. It is that. It's not that, but it's excellent at that. Like it is. I kind of thought that would be a diminishing descriptor or somehow a pejorative. And to the contrary, it really is amazing how much fun they managed to squeeze out of a very streamlined, a very simplified version of Diablo. So I'll get into some specifics. In Minecraft Dungeons, you can select – you create a character. You don't select a class. There's no classes. So that's one thing that's different than Diablo, one thing that's simpler, right? Any character can wear any piece of gear that drops. And the gear really does determine your play style, right? There's a bunch of different weapons. But you only have 3 slots – of gear on your character and then 3 what they call artifacts. And the artifacts basically give you your superpowers. The artifacts are mapped to the, you know, B, Y, and X button on the Xbox controller. And they basically give you your super, your actions that you can do over and above your melee attack and your ranged attacks. You always have a melee weapon and you always have a ranged weapon and then 1 armor type. So there's not helmets and gloves and boots, and there's just, you have armor and you have a melee weapon and you have a ranged weapon. The melee weapons have all kinds of different varieties. There's axes that give you a spin at the end of the combo. There's, you know, ranged sort of glaives and poles that give you some a distance that you can attack from. There's knives that have much faster attack speed and you need to get really up close. There's even fist weapons, all kinds of different options there. And they have three stats. They have their power, their speed, and I can't remember the third one, but very simple stuff. Very simple stuff. Again, all streamlined. You're not worrying about numbers here or numbers there very much. It has, you know, numbers shoot out when you attack things, which I like. But it really takes away some of that theory crafting that you get in Diablo games and Path of Exile and games like that, and replaces it with just permission to experiment. And I think that is the biggest thing that I am in awe of with Minecraft Dungeons, is all of the things that games like this tend to have as restrictions on the player, this game finds ways to remove. So what happens when you level up is you get a little more health, a little more attack, but you also get what they call enchantment points. And you can spend your enchantment points on weapons. Every weapon in the game, ranged and melee, has enchantments on it. And these will be like super cool things they get to do, like adding multi-shot to a crossbow, or, you know, it's simple things like making it have more damage. They call sharpness. But then there's like crazy ones, like it'll make your arrows explode, or it'll one called radiance that'll like heal people around you if on a certain randomized attack. Cool superpowers, cool rule-breaking, fun superpowers, and there's tons of them. And every item has them. The higher level items, the rarer items, have more slots of them, up to three. But every weapon has at least one. And so weapons are just in a Diablo style game. They have levels of rarity. You know, you'll have greens and blues and uniques and stuff like that. This is the first game of that type where a common gray trash item can potentially be a better equipped, usable thing than the unique that drops at the same time. Like sometimes a unique will drop and a random item, just crummy gray common item, will drop, and it'll end up being a more useful item because of its particular combination of enchantments. So it really is like, oh my gosh. Because, you know, I'm playing with my son and he is obsessed with being in the menus and looking at every single item. And I'm like, we're playing. Are we playing? Are we looking at menus? What are we doing? Are we playing? But I swiftly learned that, oh my gosh, it is worth looking at every single item, because it completely removes that, like, well, this is all trash, just vendor it or salvage it or whatever, disenchant it. That sort of tedium is replaced with, oh my gosh, every single thing that drops can be cool, can be useful, which already I'm like, good job, game. That's an impressive feat in and of itself. Then you have the fact that you invest your enchantment points on these items to decide. So basically each enchantment slot has three options and you can choose one. And then each of those options has three levels and the enchantment cost goes up each level. So you can invest and then limit yourself on that item. So you can put, you know, I guess what, up to like 24 points on each item. Well, then you've used up all your points on that item. And many games would say, sorry, that's the invested cost, not Minecraft Dungeons. It refunds your enchantment points back to you if you salvage the item, trade the item to another player, level the item up with one of their vendors. It's constantly letting you reuse items, get stuff back, reinvest points, experiment. So the sunk cost of making a rash decision is negligible. it's you can always get back the investment. You can always play with those points. Now, there's other ways in the game to gamble those points that I won't get into, but it's a really smart system that frees the player up to make cool decisions and never feel like, oh, I can't, because I'm that guy that's like, oh, my talent tree, I leveled. Well, maybe I'll hold on to my talent point and wait because I don't want to make the wrong choice. I don't want to have to pay to respec. Nah. Minecraft Dungeons, it's just like, go crazy. Have fun. Use different weapons. You want to change weapons on the fly? Awesome. And then these artifacts that you're using as well, they're really cool. They do all kinds of fun, magical things. And you can constantly, you can hot swap them on the fly in the middle of fights. It's just a game that's constantly offering up ways to free the player to play how they want. And I've been really enamored with it. I can't believe how much I like the game and think the game is made with very smart design decisions.
But are you making your son cards or what?
Yeah, no cards. No cards.
Oh, trash.
He doesn't miss the cards, though. We opened up the Apocalypse difficulty level last night, which is the second to last. There's Apocalypse Plus as well. But and I think the challenge, it retains a really wonderful amount of challenge going forward. There's tons
it's
of
also
content.
Beautiful. It's a beautiful
it really
looking
is pretty.
Game.
I mean, if you like the Minecraft aesthetic, which you know, it's all blocks, but and very, you know, old looking, but does really smart things with it. And it's a mature game at this point, right? I'm coming to it very late in its life. So there's all these DLC packs, which are also super cheap. They're like under $5 to get the DLC packs and tons of content. You know, we're kind of moving through the content slowly and we play in fits and starts, but I've had some of the most thrilling, fun sessions of gaming with my son where we almost lose to a boss and, you know, we res each other and heal each other and do it's nailing that gameplay loop, that thrilling gameplay loop of the couch co-op, PvE. You know, there's really cool DLCs. There's an underwater DLC that adds like a breathing mechanic that you have to work with. That's really clever. There's levels where they're shooting you around on catapults, and there's a lot of really clever stuff in this game. So one that I had discounted because it's like, oh, maybe a cash grab on the Minecraft IP. And even if it isn't, it's probably really dumbed down. And I find that, A, that was very unfair of me to think, and B, not dumbed down, streamlined. I think it's really effectively streamlined. And, you know, in a lot of ways, better than Diablo in some senses, you know, ways better.
The idea of having ever, when you were talking about it, and I probably put 4 hours into this game back when it came out and haven't touched it since, but maybe now I should sit my kids down and be like, we are having fun. which there was a boat that my friend saw several years ago, and the name boats always have cute like improv team names. This boat's name, it has stuck with me since, it was called Mandatory Fun. Which I
like it.
But I think the idea of every piece of loot potentially being interesting or usable is such a fascinating concept because, I mean, Alex, I'm curious your thought on that, because so many of these types of games and even games that we love that we mention almost every episode of Feeling This, you open a chest or you get a thing and probably 70% of it is just resource farming at that point, right? You're not like, ooh, a thing. It's just like, oh, I got to deconstruct that to then work toward the thing that I'm actually working toward. But I think there is something fascinating about why not make everything possibly good and how hard would it be to achieve that? And it seems like, Jeff, you were saying that Minecraft Dungeons leans that way in terms of making everything possibly worth exploring.
Yeah, it's a very tricky problem to solve, and this is again purely me speaking, right? I'm gonna make an assumption that when you're trying to build a action RPG like this for someone that's going to play it for 1,000 hours, it's a lot harder to create that balance across all the gear than it is in a game like this where you're not expecting people to play it for 1,000 hours. And I think your point, Jeff, is spot on in that the bar was not set lower. It was cast wider in terms of like, we want people to just have fun with this experience and not worry too much about, there is enough depth in here that, like you said, you can get lost in those nuances of enchantments and finding the right balance of things. But we're not, you know, this is not a game that we expect people to play for thousands of hours. Having worked on Diablo 3, lucky enough to work on Diablo 3, we had this problem all the time when we had artists making beautiful art for trash loot.
Junk.
Literally. Yeah. And there was a process they had for building the loot that we knew that people, like two-thirds of which people would never see or never care about, but had to be there as part of the leveling process, right? Just the nature, not saying that's, you know, it's a very complex system and it's very hard to build something. I would say, as a designer, I've often tried to create a game where, you know, you can take something from the very start of the game to the end of the game and still make it viable. And that is a very complex system to develop. But there's certainly merit in it, right? And if you can find the right balance, it's really interesting. Is there cutoff points? Maybe is there thresholds to sort of help streamline? Because a lot of it's the balance, right? When everything could be viable, then as the game grows, that balance just gets harder and harder to manifest because you're trying to manifest it across every possible thing as opposed to, you know, a condensed set of tiers that you're maybe expanding and then adding another tier on top of, etc. Yeah, it's a very, very hard problem to solve. And I think I've had quite a lot of, also had quite a lot of fun with Minecraft Dungeons with my youngest Reed and my middle child. I hate calling him the middle child. It sounds so weird, but my second oldest, I don't know, Grant, they both really enjoyed it. And one of their friends is super into it. And that creates a really interesting challenge where I think my kids are the opposite of your son, Jeff. They could not spend time in menus. They were like, no, I don't care. Just what is it? Just blah. But their friend who knew, had played the game so much, knew all the intricacies, it was like, no, you need that, you need this, go over here, do that, do this, go over here. And it created this really tense, this contentious moment where, like, my kids were trying to figure it out and their friend was like, no, I know everything, do this. They're like, how am I? But they still had so much fun.
Like, sounds like they invited my son over to your...
Your son knows all the details.
He's the annoying kid. He's like, no, you're doing it wrong. I try to curb that in him a bit.
It's hard though, Jeff. It's so hard.
It is. It's hard. And often he's wrong that he doesn't know everything.
Well, actually, you're the one doing it wrong.
Yes.
I'm like, hey... I've been on planet way longer than you. You don't know more than me. Oh, mate, sure, Dad. Okay, Dad.
There are so many paid DLC conversations we could have, Jeff, about my kids and your kids. Honestly, like so many. But yes, continue.
Really, Dad? So you're more skilled than me? Here, let's play a first-person shooter on this iPad using touch controls. Yeah. Show me how it's done, Grandpa.
All right, Dad. You win. Let's try to get out of bed without moaning. Oh, you win.
And please know that all I said was not me like further acknowledging you winning. It was me getting out of bed while saying you win.
The other thing that Minecraft Dungeons does that I think reinforces this, like, let's just give the players what they want on a certain level, is everything stacks. Everything stacks. Do you want this? You want to have this enchantment on one item and this the same enchantment on another one? Guess what? It works. It stacks. Both of them are working for you. You know, do you want to have three of the same item? Yep. They'll all work. And guess what? They're on different cooldowns, not on the same. We'll just let you play how you want to play. You want to have a bunch of pets? You want to have all these different items that give you pets? Guess what? Do it. You can have, it doesn't replace your pet by having a second pet. No, we'll just keep throwing them in there. It's just a game where every design decision seems to reinforce that freedom of what your best case scenario of how you would want this to work is actually how it works. Instead of going, no, sorry, player, no. Well, no, you can't do that because that would break the game. You know, and to be able to do that, I think, is impressive. And to be able to do that in the context of continuing to create challenge and not making the game just walk all over it, I think is cool too. You don't see that often. And I mean, I know I've been talking about this older game for a while now, but I'm just very impressed, having had such low expectations for it, how much I want the lessons here to apply to other games, you know. I think it would be cool to have more games give that kind of freedom to the player over and over again.
Mm-hmm. Just quickly, their level design is really good as well, with that isometric camera they have and the way they lay things out, the way they stack things on top of each other. They always create really easy ways to get back up onto that level, or they don't, and they're like, oh, how do I, there's a bridge up here, how do I find my way around? Like, they do, the whole level design of that game is really smart as well.
Completely agree. And they don't give camera control to the player, right? It's a fixed camera. So you are beholden to their level design to understand where you're going and how to get there. And sometimes it's a little bewildering, but sometimes that's the puzzle of it. Mm-hmm. It's really good. And there's also a tower mode that we've been playing a bunch that resets after a few days and has like fixed items at every level of the tower. You see how far you can go in almost a road.
They're great riffs.
It's a very well done game. Is it doing anything new? Not really. It's doing things other games do, but it's doing it in a very streamlined, cool way. Anyway, so that's Minecraft Dungeons. I've been playing it a lot. All right. Well, that's going to bring us to the end of DLC. We do have parting gifts coming up, so stick around for those. Alex Solman, it's always so much fun talking to you. The folks can hear you every single week in season 3 of Feeling This. All you got to do is become a patron at patreon.com/DLCpod. But where else can they follow your exploits online?
Oh, I'm not on the internet. I mean, I'm on the internet, but I don't use the internet socially that much. I'm on your DLC, Discord, as much as I can be in between work. And I'm on Instagram. I think I changed to Peculiar Pelican. That's my new handle. So I think I'm Peculiar Pelican on Instagram, but you can just look me up as Alex Solman.
Wonderful. Well, that means that the best way to hear more Alex and Christian is to become a patron at any level and get those fantastic Feeling This episodes.
Or right 21 Jump Street it and try to blend in with Alex's kids to get those awesome video game history lessons. Hello, fellow youths. I'm here for the Video Game History Club. I heard there's a rich friend here that owns a Neo Geo. I'd like to play that.
I'm the middle child.
I'm the middle-aged child. Where do I?
Christian Spicer, what do you got going on this week?
A new installment of Let's Chat Games should be coming out on Friday. Keeping should, but I have an idea for it. I just got to get it down in a written form, but that is my free newsletter. Very conversational about video games. People can find it at christianspicer.substack.com. I always do my best to reply to everyone who replies to me. Again, I like the conversation. It's informal. I really, really enjoy them. Hopefully people check those out. New one should be coming out this Friday. And then this show, this very show, this DLC Empire that you're listening to, you can find us on Threads and Instagram at DLC Hype Train and also on YouTube at DLC Pod. And we put out bespoke little 1-minute videos, usually twice a week on Instagram and also on YouTube as shorts, where Jeff and I do our best to answer a question in 1 minute or less. I think the last one we put out was maybe what our thoughts were about the Switch successor and whether or not it could achieve the success that the Switch has already. And it's a fun little 1 minute. So folks can find those online and hold us to it 7 years from now and see if we were right.
Indeed. You can follow me on socials. I'm at Jeff Cannata, which is spelled with 2 N's and 1 T. I also have other shows, the Filmcast being one. We talk about movies and TV shows. I also do We Have Concerns, which is a comedy show about science. And the Fan Controlled Show, which is at Fan Controlled Sports and Entertainment. We're talking about mostly NASCAR lately, which I'm getting a crash course in, no pun intended, because Fan Controlled NASCAR is happening, Fan Controlled Racing.
Come on, F1. We're going to get you.
Maybe. You'll see. We'll see.
Today's race was wild.
Really?
Wild.
No spoilers. I haven't watched it yet.
Oh, sorry. Okay. Wow. I won't say anything else then.
That's all good.
All right. Let's wrap the show up now with our parting gifts. Hey, give us a suggestion. Give us a parting gift. This is your parting gift. Alex, do you have a suggestion to help people get through their week?
I do. Yeah, this is a little bit of an older cartoon now that's on Netflix called Battle Kitty. The reason I love it is because it's an interactive show on Netflix. So they have like a little world map and you can kind of move yourself around the map and each dot on the map is an episode. It's super video game inspired, clearly. But the one that really got me is there is an episode where it's basically about this little cat and this orc in this crazy world going around having adventures. And there's an episode where one of the characters gets stuck in the geometry of the world. And it reminded me of being a QA tester years ago, finding those bugs. Do you remember when games that would happen, right? You would just spawn and you'd be like half in the ground or like 2 feet off the ground and like you don't know why. There's so many really deep video game cuts in that show. Clearly, they're devout video game fans. But it's super funny. It's got some very good jokes for the adults. My kids adored it, and my youngest Reed watched it so much. It's also super positive in a lot of its messages. It's just a brilliant cartoon. And like I've watched it as an adult several times, and I love it when my kids do. So highly recommended.
Awesome. I never heard of this, so I'm going to check this out. Battle Kitty is what it's called. It's on Netflix. I kind of want to go next, actually. Christian, hang on 1 second, because I also have a kitten-based Netflix animated show to share with you. And it just feels like I should go next. My parting gift is Exploding Kittens, which is one of those improbable things where a cartoon based on a very successful kickstarted card game is good? Yes, in this case, I think it is. Exploding Kittens was, probably have heard of it, a very, 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 very successful Kickstarter campaign for a goofy card game, tabletop card game. I think it started its life as a webcomic perhaps, but now it is a Netflix animated series. And I'm laughing my butt off at it. It is quite funny. The concept being that God is assigned by the angels, has to go down to Earth and help people as a cat. He gets put in the body of a cat and goes down and is lives with his family of goofballs. And it's a really fun family of goofballs because the dad is like a tabletop gamer. There's a lot of jokes about tabletop gamers in it. The son is a wannabe influencer who was sort of became virally popular when he was really young and is constantly chasing that dragon, trying to recapture some internet relevance again, even as a young man. And the mom is like this survivalist, crazy survivalist, like intense, militant person. I think it has some very funny jokes. I was laughing a lot. I think the animation's fun. I highly recommend Exploding Kittens. So Battle Kitty and Exploding Kittens, both on Netflix. Both recommended by us. Christian, take us in a different direction.
Wildly different, but maybe connects in terms of battles, because it's where a lot of Game of Thrones was filmed. I literally just got back from Croatia. Like yesterday morning, I was in Croatia. We had some friends plan a trip out there and then invite us along. And we were like, we're going. I knew Game of Thrones filmed there. I knew beautiful scenery in Game of Thrones. But I'll be honest, never on my list of like places I was dying to go. I have a hard time when I go to Europe and I just see Italy. And I'm like, that's where I'm going. And I have a hard time even thinking about the back half of Italy that is on the Adriatic Sea, kind of goes over where Croatia is. I'm like, go ahead.
People have told me that Croatia is basically what Italy was in like the late 80s. Like it's basically, it's like cheaper Italy.
honestly, the most amazing, beautiful place I've maybe ever been.
Yeah.
We were fortunate to be able to go to a bunch of the islands. Swimming in the Adriatic Sea is just mind-blowing. It is so calm. It is so calm. And all the beaches are rock beaches because, again, the Adriatic is so calm. There aren't waves hitting the shore the way there are here in California or in the Mediterranean that creates that sand over wear and tear. And so you want to have some like Tevas on or something like that when you're on the beach, but it also means that you can just go out and sploosh and swim like it's a giant saltwater lake in terms of how calm the water is. And there's not a lot of dangerous marine life either. And the waters are so clear and so blue. And if you are a Game of Thrones fan, we flew into, I mean, maybe I'll talk about it on a Wednesday show. Getting there was an ordeal.
Did you take your kids or did you go by yourselves?
We did. We took the kids. They loved it as well because Southern California, the beach is very different, right? Like we don't swim in the beach. It's cold. There's a fear of sharks and also waves and rip currents and all these things that, you know, you splash in it and maybe you skimboard in it, but you don't swim in it. And Croatia, you're swimming in it. You just walk into it and then swim as far as you want. It's unbelievable. And we flew into Dubrovnik, which is where a lot of Game of Thrones is filmed. The Shame. I'll just leave it at that in case people are still catching up on that show. Was filmed there. And then we also went to Split, where where they kept their dragons is a real old ancient fortress that we got to go in and see and how old this stuff is. There are just walls everywhere that are like 2,000 year old that are just still there because they're just there everywhere. Anyway, my parting gift is
Alex is like, yawn, that's called my backyard.
Not that old. I mean, parts of it, but
all of us in the States are like, it's older than 400 years. It's the craziest thing.
Yeah. So my parting gift is two. One is visit Croatia if you're thinking of a place to go visit. And two, perhaps the broader parting gift is broaden your horizons of places you didn't think you were interested in going or have on your list, because I do have a hard time not going to Italy for pizza, pasta, and gelato.
How was the food in Croatia, though?
Dude, so dang good. One, they're
the
still
lead. You buried the lead, Christian, on the food.
There's still pizza, pasta, gelato, but you also have influences from the rest of Eastern Europe and that area coming in to creating, and plus tons of seafood if you eat meat, which I don't. But apparently, some of the best scallops and mussels and oysters in the world because of the brackish water that you're able to get where the rivers meet the Adriatic, and the Adriatic's very salty. But delicious and amazing and only good things to say. Absolutely wonderful time. Go explore the world.
All right. We got a listener-suggested parting gift as well. This actually wasn't sent in as a parting gift, but I'm going to use it as one because I think it works. And I appreciate Brian sending this into dlcfeedback@gmail.com. Brian says, with the recent No Man's Sky update, which – very well could have been a story of the week. It has been numerous times in the past. But Brian says, I felt compelled to write in with a futile plea to all my wonderful fellow DLC listeners, and really all gamers as a whole for that matter, to really start championing Hello Games and using them as the standard for other game publishers. For 8 years now, Hello Games has constantly put more and more content into No Man's Sky than really anyone has even asked for. I'd even argue that No Man's Sky has had the most content added to it than any other live service game ever, with the exception of maybe Fortnite. Curious if you three can challenge my claim. We've had plenty of examples of publishers and studios who we champion as the good guys before. The positive sentiment we hold for Larian Studios now, the way we talked about CD Projekt Red pre-Cyberpunk launch when The Witcher 3 was on fire. We should be talking about Hello Games whenever the opportunity arises, whenever applicable, just as much now. Hello Games asked me to buy No Man's Sky one time. And you can even wait till it's on sale if you want. And then that's all it asks of you. Even after 8 years, there's still no way to spend a penny on No Man's Sky outside of buying another copy of the game. It never asks for the player to buy a battle pass. It doesn't have a store for cosmetics and experience boosters. No currencies to buy in weird amounts that don't match how much you need exactly. So you got to buy more than you wanted to. And other monetization methods. It doesn't have any of them. Hello Games should really be recognized as a leader in this industry for their commitment on how to make a great game and care about your players. Anyways, thanks for letting me rant. I'll always be a big fan of the show and look forward to my Monday mornings every week. Thank you, Brian. I'm curious what you guys think of that, just in quick response. What do you think, Alex? Pretty good stuff from No Man's Sky, from, you know, long way from where they came when it launched and everybody's kind of general disappointment.
Yeah, amazing. Talk about a game that if you dive into late, you know, what you get to experience, right? Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's not just the piling on of additional content, it's the fundamental changing of the experience that they've done over many years, right? They've grown what you can do in that game, you know, that other games that come out, you know, struggle to match, right? You know, over that time in terms of the complexity and the mechanics. So yeah, completely agree. Hello Games are really just ambitious and really, really bold in order to keep going that. And props to Sony for keeping it going, right? They've continued to, you know, they supported it for a while and then, you know, Hello Games have run with it. So
yeah. Yeah. And I don't begrudge anyone the desire to sell additional content for games, but it is extraordinary to see that they can still be making new content and not asking for more money for it. I do think that is an extraordinary business model that seems to be working for Hello Games. So amazing, amazing stuff. And fantastic that Brian sent in this to dlcfeedback@gmail.com. If you'd like to have your parting gift read on the show, send it to us at that address, dlcfeedback@gmail.com. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of DLC. Thanks again to Christian Spicer and Alex Solomon for hanging out with me. Thanks to our musical contributors, Patrick L., Sean Madigan, and Zero Star for those fun bumpers. Our theme song was created by White Cube, which is Jason Sherry and T. Ryan Arnold. You can get swag for the show at store.dlcpod.com. And think about supporting us. We are so grateful to our patrons for making this show possible. As we said, we're trying to increase the value of that patronage any way we can. And Alex has been so awesome to help out with that effort by being part of Feeling This, which is exclusive to our patrons. If you have other ideas of what you'd like as Patreon rewards to incentivize your patronage, we'd love to hear them. Specifically, our Hype Train patrons, we've sort of gotten to the point now where we were making video games for everybody. Now we want to find a new way, a new thing for the Hype Train patrons as your thing. If you are one or thinking about becoming one, drop us a line. Let us know how we could make that special, because certainly your high level of support is extremely special to us. DLCfeedback@gmail.com is a great place to do that, or on the Discord. 5x5 DLC. All right. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week. Until then, think about what you put out into the world. Make it a better place.